Welcome to Work From Your Happy Place, the podcast that equips you with the tools, know-how, and motivation to live your dreams and find your happy place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a recap of the week's guests and a preview of what's in store. To sign up, simply text the word happy place with no space to 33444. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the host of Work From Your Happy Place, Belinda Ellsworth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Work From Your Happy Place. I'm your host, Belinda, and we're going to have a great time on the show today. I have a wonderful guest, Andrea Owen. She's an author, coach, podcast host, and a hellraiser. Andrea Owen is creating a global impact in women's empowerment with her books being translated into 18 languages and available in 22 countries. She helps high-achieving women maximize unshakable confidence and master resilience. You are going to be able to hear some great insights and some wonderful stories from Andrea today. So, Andrea, welcome to the show.
Hi, Belinda. I'm very excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, absolutely. So why don't you just fill in some of the gaps of that bio and tell us how you came to do what you're doing today. Tell us a little bit more about that journey and in the title of that great book. And let's just get to know Andrea a little bit better.
Well, it was a bit of an interesting sort of invitation. That's the word that I like to use when I'm talking about how I got here, an invitation from the universe, if you will. And I heard about life coaching in 2003. So this was long before it became mainstream. And I was married before to my first husband. Not like I have 17 husbands. I've only had two. I'm still married to this. but I was married before and I was telling him about it. And I said, this sounds so neat to do this life coaching and to do it. I feel like you would need more life experience than I have. And I was in my late 20s at the time. And lo and behold, 2 years later, be careful what you wish for. The universe handed me my life experience when that husband had an affair with our neighbor and got her pregnant. And we quickly divorced. I got into a new relationship with someone else whom I thought was fantastic. And it turns out the whole time we were together, he lied about having terminal cancer to cover up his drug addiction. I had essentially been conned. I was still legally married to my first husband and going through all kinds of drama with that. And I found myself pregnant, and I was pregnant with the fake cancer guy's baby.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
Alone. And I had broken the lease to my apartment because he and I were going to move away together. So I had no place to live. I had also quit my job that I loved because he and I were going to move. And I was laying on the floor in the fetal position, as one does when they're having their dark night of the soul. And I was on the phone with my sister crying. And I thought to myself, how did I get here? I was 31 at the time. It wasn't like I was a 16-year-old girl. You know, I knew how birth control worked. Like I knew kind of how I had gotten there, and I had to take radical responsibility for my life. And the common denominator for both of those incredibly dysfunctional and abusive relationships was me. And this is not to let the men off the hook. They did some pretty awful things to me and had their own work to do, but I had ignored my intuition that told me First to not marry my first husband. My intuition had told me when I was 19 to leave that relationship, and I did not. My intuition told me on the first date with the fake cancer guy that something wasn't right, and I ignored it. And I was in a bad place. And so I picked myself up and started from the beginning and looked in the mirror at where were my shadows and dysfunctions and behaviors and coping mechanisms that weren't working for me. And it was the most uncomfortable place I had ever been. Cause honestly, Belinda, I had loved blaming other people. Like all my problems were other people's fault. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do that anymore. So that's what brought me here. And I signed up for life coaching certification. I went deep into my own therapy, and that was 15 years ago. And here I am.
Wow. That's a story.
I gave you like the very, very short version.
Oh my goodness. But you know what? I'm curious about one thing if you want to share that, but it's like, you said the common denominator was you. And I do think stop blaming others and taking responsibility and seeing the common denominator was you in that. But why do you think you ignored that intuition Like, I think intuition is a really key ingredient that a lot of people ignore for a variety of reasons. But why do you think you ignored that?
Yeah. And you pointed to something really important, and we don't have to get into it too much, but I do think that it's not talked about enough that many people ignore their intuition because of previous trauma and its family of origin stuff, where they have been told for so long that their reality is wrong. So they don't. It's essentially gaslighting that happens to people, and they tend to ignore their intuition. For me personally, I ignored it because I didn't want to be alone. I knew that if I listened to my intuition and broke up with my boyfriend when I was 19, and then, you know, again, heard my intuition when I was in my early 20s to leave the relationship, but instead decided to move in with him, again, ignored my intuition when it said, don't marry him. And I married him when I was 27. I would have had to start over. And I could not bear the thought of having to walk away and, you know, start dating again. And, you know, I had history with him, and it's all the list of things that so many people make when they're thinking about leaving a relationship, when they're sort of weighing out the pros and cons. And then in the second time, I ignored it because I was in a place where I was ashamed of where I had ended up. You know, I was like, mm-hmm. 30 at the time, and all my friends were getting married and or having babies. And I was the only one who was divorced. And I would have rather have been in a terrible relationship than no relationship. That was something I had to admit. And a lot of times we ignore our intuition because to do the thing that our intuition is telling us to do is incredibly uncomfortable, is going to take mm-hmm. an enormous amount of courage. And we just aren't in a place where we have it yet. Or we just don't trust ourselves enough to know that our intuition is actually rooting for us. We're going to be okay on the other end. Comes down to self-trust, and I didn't have any of that.
Wow. And I do think that it is that self-trust. I love that you said you didn't want to be alone, because I think that's very real, which is fear. It comes down to not listening to our intuition, in a very large part is that fear.
Yeah. And for me, it was also pretty severe codependence. Okay. I was a bit of a mess. And I say that very candidly and also lovingly. Like, I don't mean to be self-deprecating. I have done so much work on myself and have, you know, for lack of a better term, like healed my inner child. And I actually even have a picture of myself from when I was 18, because I often like cheer her on and salute her and tell her how proud of her I am. Oh my gosh, it ruled my life. And I was obsessed with taking care of everybody else. I was obsessed with controlling things. I thought, if only people behaved the way that I thought they should, everybody's life is going to be easier. My life is going to be easier. Your life is going to be easier. I in no way wanted to take responsibility for any of my ways of not being okay.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit then about, you started doing life coaching. So you became certified, you kind of did some healing process in that. And then you just started working with other individuals, kind of going through some of the same types of challenges.
I did. I mean, that's how it started out early on. And so this was I started coaching around 2008 and started a blog. You know, 2008 was like 100 years ago in internet years, and started writing a lot and realized that what I was writing about, a lot of people resonated with and related to. And so I was just kind of in the beginning, which I think a lot of us do, is, you know, you kind of coach everybody to figure out what your niche is and who you're best at coaching at. So that's how I really started. It was just mostly working one-on-one with clients.
Great. And then you went, at what point in this journey did you write your book?
Started writing my first book, I think around 2011, 2012. So that was right after I got sober and sat up one morning and decided I was going to write a book, that I was done just talking about it. And everything sort of fell into place serendipitously. Again, I don't think really anything is serendipitous, but it did sort of fall into place. I had a literary agent that took a chance on an unknown author, and it worked out. And then I wrote my second book in 2016. That was also the same year that my dad died. So that was rough, right? Having to finish a manuscript and losing my father. And then this latest book I wrote, I started writing it right when the pandemic hit in 2020. So the universe is hilarious. So I've written a few manuscripts during difficult times in my life. It's possible.
I think though, sometimes that's when we're really pouring out is when we're having all those feelings. And so it's easier to pour out things when you are going through that. Sometimes I feel.
Yeah, I think it depends on the person. And I also think that you have to have the right amount of support. I mean, when my dad died, it was also unexpected. And I did not have that much extra time to finish my manuscript. But it did end up serving a purpose where I went back to one of the chapters where it was applicable and wrote about my own experience and how I walked through that. And for me, one of the biggest triumphs was not drinking. At the time, I think I had 5 or 6 years of sobriety. And ironically, my dad was also sober. When he passed away, he had 20 some odd years of sobriety. And it was just a really difficult time. And then when COVID happened, I decided to hire a new therapist. And I'm so glad that I did, because I think COVID brought up a lot of stuff for a lot of people. And I was no exception. So yes, I had really great support during both of those difficult times.
Great. So how has the business, so your life coaching, writing, how has that business today affected your lifestyle?
Well, it's been fantastic. I mean, I was just thinking the other morning, like, I'm so grateful that I don't have to rush around every morning to be out the door to get to a place of work on time. And I'm blown away that I get to work from home. You know, when everybody was kind of freaking out about working from home last year in 2020, I just was like, what can I do to help? Because I've been doing this for a long time and I have so many pointers for everyone. And it's been incredible. Like, I didn't plan this out. I'm the accidental entrepreneur. I don't know about you, Belinda, but I was not the kid that liked selling Girl Scout cookies. I just hated it. I was not the kid that had the lemonade stand. My parents, in fact, it worked retail forever and didn't encourage me to do that. But my older sister worked for an orthodontist and they wanted me to go that same route because that was like a good stable job. And I just was like, I am so bad with authority. Like, I don't think it's a good idea for me to have a boss that I have to answer to. So it's changed my life in so many ways. I don't think it's for everybody, but it's worked out really, really fantastically for me.
That is great. No, I have to say, I was the kid that sold. I wasn't even a Girl Scout, and I helped my best friend at the time in grade school sell the most Girl Scout cookies of anybody.
I think that's amazing.
My mom won't let me be a Girl Scout, but you know what? I am going to sell the most Girl Scout cookies here no matter what. So I'll just do it through her.
Yeah. Well, and I don't necessarily think that, you know, it's so funny because so many people have told me, like, Andrea, why aren't you in direct sales? Like, or at least just sales in general. And it's not that I don't like it. I think that either you have a background like yours where you were a kid and were just like good at selling and that's how you learn all of the skills to selling. And then there's people like me who are extroverts and just naturally enthusiastic and charismatic and just can draw people in with my personality and can sell you a watch, you know, from my jacket. So I don't think that, like, I've never been hard on myself that, you know, that I wasn't a salesperson as a child. It is so something that can be learned just with a little enthusiasm and some drive.
You know, what's interesting is you made such a really, really great point, though, and I tell everybody that, like, if you peel away the onion, the number one ingredient, it really is enthusiasm and drawing people in, and we're selling people all of the time. And so people have sometimes a super negative connotation toward sales when, in fact, it's a natural part of what we do in our regular everyday lives, and it's learning how to embrace that if you are representing a product and in not feeling like you have to be quote unquote salesy or pushy, but that you have natural abilities that allow you to connect with people and help solve their problems. And so that's mm-hmm. a natural thing of what you do anyway, whether you identify that as selling, you certainly are. You're selling right. You know, and you're selling your ability to help other women that are going down a similar path or going through this journey or whatever the case may be. And it's really about that sheer enthusiasm and about being able to draw people in. I really do believe that's the first criteria. Yeah. And when people can understand that, sometimes that helps make those negative connotations about sales kind of sort of go away or dissolve.
100%. Yeah. I mean, and you and I both know it's mostly about building relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Gosh. So let's talk about your skill sets, like your superpowers. What have you identified as a couple of your superpowers that you think have really contributed to your overall success?
You know, it's funny. I was just asking my best friend this question, and she's been my best friend for at least a dozen years. And she said, without missing a beat, she said, your ability to take action once you make a decision very quickly. And I'm also typically quick to make a decision. And sometimes this has come to bite me in the butt. I will tell you that. I don't know if you're familiar with the Kolbe scale, the Kolbe index, I think it's called. And it's, you know, and just another one of those personality things that breaks you into four different types. And I'm what they call a quick start. So I can take action very quickly. And also where it's not my superpower is that sometimes I accidentally cut corners and my friend calls me Ms. Hasty because I'm so quick and fast at things. But again, I think it's my superpower because I don't agonize over things. I rarely agonize. I should say that. Sometimes I do, but I rarely agonize over things. I just make a decision and learn my lessons retrospectively instead of a person who tries to learn their lessons prospectively, which is so difficult, I feel like, because we haven't done it yet. And then, right. You know, then they're kind of like, well, I don't know if I want to jump. And I'm like already halfway there and have stumbled and fallen. And so, yeah, that's one of my superpowers.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that term. I have not heard that term before, learn retrospectively. I love that term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've had to, you know, learn retrospectively so many times. And again, it's not always been great.
Right. So Andrea, let's talk about greatest accomplishments. What would you identify as one of those?
Oh my gosh. Is it too broad to say my greatest accomplishment is completely changing my life over the course of like a couple of years?
No, not at all.
To the story that I was telling earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh. And you also shared earlier in our pre-interview that obviously your second book being translated into 18 languages and 22 mm-hmm. countries. Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah, that was for sure a professional achievement that was beyond my wildest dreams. I was 11 years old and a voracious reader. And I remember sitting in my bed reading books. And that was one thing that I'm grateful that my parents never said no to, whether it was the library or the bookstore, books were always a yes. And I thought how cool it would be to be an author. And so when, you know, my second book came out and they, you know, the email came in with the foreign deal and that was exciting. And then a couple of more came through and that was also exciting. And then they just kept coming in. And I asked my literary agent, I said, is this normal, you know, to have this many foreign rights deals? And he said, no, not for nonfiction, and anything over 4 or 5 is a lot. And they just kept coming. And yeah, it turned out to be 18, actually 19 if you count Iran. But believe it or not, they don't have copyright laws over there. So you can just do whatever you want and publish whatever you want. And so if someone tagged me in a post on Instagram, the from Iran, and I was like, I never got paid for that. So it's actually 19 languages and 23 countries. But yeah.
All right. In the name of that book?
The name of that book, well, I'm still talking about How to Stop Feeling Like Shit. All of those foreign deals were through that book. So the next book, Make Some Noise, that one comes out this summer.
Oh, great. So, and so that obviously the second book resonated with a lot of people, probably title something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. And I think, you know, this day and age, I think titles matter. They really, really do. And I also think, and I'm not trying to undermine my talent in any way, but I just think, you know, if you look at it through a pop culture lens, there were a lot of titles that had curse words in them. And my first book actually did too, that came out in 2013. And so, you know, I don't want to say I started the trend, but it matched my brand and things like that. But yeah, all that to say that titles very much matter and just what's going on, what's relevant and selling at the moment.
So make some noise. Let's talk a little bit about that. And what's the major message in this book?
This book is really about, it's written mostly for women, although men do buy my books and message me on social media and tell me that they got a lot out of it. So I'm incredibly grateful for them. And it's about, you know, I felt like I couldn't write another book without naming the elephant in the room, and that is the culture that raised us. I feel that as women, we're brought up to feel both at the same time too much and not enough. And, you know, we live in a culture that conditions us to be quiet, to not make a scene, not make too much noise, to put everyone else before us, to not make anyone else uncomfortable, to be selfless. You know, that's what it means to be a good woman or a good mother. And what I noticed year after year after year, after working with so many clients at this point, that so much of what women struggle with is rooted in their conditioning and how they were raised, not only by their parents, but by the culture at large. That's what I'm talking about in this book. Like, how do we simultaneously live in this culture? You know, I'm not asking women to flip tables and flip off their boss and, you know, and run amok. I'm just asking them to look curiously about it and ask them the question, you know, what is your conditioning versus what is your truth? And start having this conversation on a larger scale.
Great. So I know you talk a lot about self-confidence. So what would you say are three tips for helping women gain more self-confidence?
I think the first one is to give yourself the dignity of your own process and give other people the dignity of their own process. So I'll give you an example. I'm in this Facebook group with, gosh, probably 40 or 50,000 women who are the same age as me. We're all in our 30s and we're all members of the same type of workout. And inevitably the conversation in this group happens about, you know, aging, whether it's about Botox or, you know, fillers or something like that. And always there is one or two women that jump in and are basically chastising the original poster and saying, aging is a gift given to so few. Don't do that to your face. Just embrace it. You know, if we all embraced it, the beauty industry would change. And that makes me so upset because, like, both are true, right? Like, yes, of course, aging is a gift that's given to not everyone. And we should be incredibly grateful that we get to see our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. And at the same time, like, give people the dignity of their own process. Like, to me, that's what feminism is. It's just like letting women do whatever they want. If you want to change the way your face looks, then by all means, you should have the choice to do that. Like, let's not judge each other. Just give people the dignity of whatever it is, however they want to do it. And, you know, that's more of kind of like an introspective tip, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I also think that this comes down to, and I know I'm not the first person probably even to say this on your podcast, you have to start before you're ready. It's one of those like age old tips around confidence, and nothing has changed. Like, we have to not wait until we feel like we are the most competent. And I think women especially vastly undervalue how competent they actually are. And they wait to take action until they have more certifications, until they have more experience, until they have more hours or whatever it is. And it's not about getting the result every single time you take that action. It's just about having the courage, even if it's just for a few seconds, making the phone call, reaching out to somebody on social media, you know, about your product that you're selling, whatever the action is, so that you can sometimes get rejected. We will. Absolutely. I can guarantee that. But that you're okay on the other end. I mean, that's how we build our resilience muscle. That's how we understand that we're going to be okay. Is it going to hurt? Absolutely. Are you going to still be alive? Yes, you are. So that's my second tip. I'm going to take a breath. Is there anything that you want to add to that? I'm curious what your thoughts are.
No, I think you're doing great.
Well, and then the last tip around having confidence is more of kind of like a tool that I love to play with myself, and that's having an alter ego.
And okay.
When I was, and this is also, you know, something that Beyonce had as Sasha Fierce, you know, Christina Aguilera as ex-Tina. When I lived in another state around 2012, I played roller derby. And if you know the sport at all, most of the players have what we call derby names. And mine was Veronica Vane. And for me, Veronica Vane she really only cared about two things, like kicking butt out on the track and looking really amazing. Like, she was my alter ego. And, you know, what did I love about her? I loved that she really didn't care what anybody thought of her. She did not apologize when she shoulder checked somebody on the track. And that's what I think about when I think about doing something hard. You know, what would Veronica Vane do? And a lot of times changes the outcome for me.
Wow, that's super interesting. The thing about doing, you know, it is a complete cycle. And I think that is what women especially just don't understand. You know, you gain confidence from knowledge, and you don't gain the knowledge until you do. And then the more you do, the more you learn, and the more confidence you gain along the way. So it's like this mm-hmm. circle that keeps going. And I think that's part of women's problem, is they get in the circle of it and they just keep going round and round in their thoughts, and instead of diving in and just doing. And
exactly.
But it is interesting, because you will, once you dive in and do, you like you said, you'll learn retrospectively. You'll go, oh, I like the way that felt, but I'm going to change this because I don't like the way this felt. Or, mm-hmm. wow, now that I've done it, I realize that doesn't really quite work the way it worked in my head, or on paper, or in a textbook, or wherever you learned that. And so in real life, this is how it works. And so you get, I like to call it experiential knowledge. You get right. that experiential knowledge. You can read a textbook all day long, but you get the experiential knowledge from doing. So, mm-hmm. and then for me, that gains confidence. But I do think there's a big difference between self-confidence and then self-esteem. And I think that's where the real work for a lot of people needs to be done.
Yeah, to me, self-esteem is like what you actually think of yourself. And then self-confidence is like, do I think that I can do it? Do I think I can do it well? Do I think I can complete it? It's more around the action of it. And to mm-hmm. me, self-esteem is more who you are as a human being. It's wrapped up in your worth. It's wrapped up in self-trust and self-acceptance. It's a little deeper, at least in my opinion.
Absolutely. And that's probably where having that sort of alter ego can kind of help sometimes mm-hmm. to sort of push you into thinking about yourself a little bit differently.
Yeah, I think it's such a process. And I'm sure you agree with me on that. And I also feel like, for me personally, I'm curious if this was your experience as well, because I think we're about the same age. And, you know, when I was 30, like I felt like I was grown, but at the same time, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was made of. I didn't know what I was capable of. I felt so lost personally, and, you know, within my core self. And I just turned 46, and I feel like I am just now starting to really get to know who I am, what I am made of, and have so much more confidence. I do think that some of it comes with age and wisdom and experience. And I believe that you can accelerate the process if you dive in and if you take action and learn along the way. What do you think?
It's interesting. So I'll just speak to that. So at like 30, I was like on the career path, you know, like I was trying to get to the next level. I was trying to get promoted. I was trying to get where I wanted to be, and I wanted to be, you know, the youngest sales vice president within my company before I turned 30. And so at 29, there I was, and amongst women much, much older than myself. And then kind of like, okay, what do I do now? And then that became a real sort of self-exploring of what do I really want to do? So I've really accomplished a lot. Now what do I want to do? And so that led me into my motivational speaking and sales training. And so I've kind of gone along and done that. And I would say to you at 46, yeah, I was probably like living the dream. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like living life. My life was good. I had gotten divorced. I had gotten remarried. I restarted another family. It was like, wow. And then it's been real interesting. So I am a little bit older than you. So I just had my 60th birthday just in January. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting because I started getting, it was two, if I'm going to be really honest. I had one client say, they were ready to hire me to speak at their conference. And I was like, you know, thought it was a done deal. And then I called back just to get the contracts and follow through. And one of the gentlemen there that I knew had known for a long time, he said, they've decided to go in a different direction. I said, for what reason? Uh-huh. I'm just be honest. He said, they thought you were too old.
No.
Oh yeah. 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 And so that began a cycle for me of, and I hate to even like admit this, like that became a cycle of, I was like probably 54 at that time, 55. Mm-hmm. And that became a cycle of self-doubt that I can't even describe. And finally, like, I don't know what it was, but it was like, how can you let one person shift this? Although I kind of was hearing those grumblings. And so a lot of that comes from, that's why I think women deal with the crap they deal with. You know what I mean? It's the way, because when I was young, it was like, oh, when you get older, then you're older and you're too old. Like, right. It's like, really? Because they don't do that to men.
They don't.
They don't say those things to men at all. And, but then I was able to, you know, I kind of lost my way for a little bit, probably for a few years. And I've got to say that, believe it or not, COVID is what helped me really get my confidence back. Because I was completely out of speaking engagements and how we were going to earn income. And so I was like, all right, I need to dig in here and I need to up my game in everything that I'm doing. And what I did was really got out of my sort of stagnant comfort box. I mean, that's the only best way I can say it. I had had my business for 26 years and it was kind of going along. And then I was thinking, yeah, I probably should think about like maybe doing something different. I don't know. And then it was just like, no, dig in your heels. And that's where we really started like promoting the podcast. I became more active on LinkedIn. We started working more from the brand Work From Your Happy Place. But then I started showing up with what I did before, just in a different way, and really worked on my confidence of being on video, which I was always really great being live, but not going live on video every day. Mm-hmm. But during COVID, that's what you had to do, right?
Yeah.
So I perfected those skills and learned a lot and watched a lot of people. I went back to school on myself. I mean, I really did. And now my business is like, you know, grown. We've gained like 10,000 new followers in just since COVID of people that never had even heard of me before. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so it has been an interesting journey that I think as women start to cross out of that and get a little bit closer to 50 is to really identify, you know, what's this next chapter look like, and not get wrapped into what you've always done before and that is not the story anymore, and that we can create a new story at whatever age we are. I feel more confident about that right now today than I did 3 years ago.
Yes. I love that story and I love your takeaways. And I agree with everything you said. And at the same time, I think it's both. I think yes, that you can create, you know, something new, you can gain confidence after something difficult that's happened to you. And at the same time, personally, I can't ignore that you were dismissed. That's ageism is what it is. And like, that's the thing that I can't be with, because, and that's part of why I wrote this book, is because we face things like that typically men do not. And I remember I had a mentor in the speaking industry, and I was talking to her. This was several years ago. I was 37, and she asked me how old I was. She's like, "How old are you again?" And she was older. I think she was in her late 50s at the time. And I told her, I said, "I'm 37." She goes, "Oh, perfect. That's the sweet spot. Old enough to be taken seriously, but not too old where you're invisible." And this was a woman that was telling me this, and that struck me. And I thought, okay, well, what's the age when I become invisible? And she didn't mean any harm by it. She was being candid with me, and she wasn't lying. And she was just telling me the truth. And like, that's the thing I want to change, Belinda. Like, and that I want to just call out and like say, this is unacceptable. Like, this is absolutely unacceptable. We live in a culture that is obsessed with beauty and youth, and we do not put enough value on experience. And I mean, that's the hill I'm going to die on. I'll tell you what, like,
well, interesting enough, it was the gentleman that was the, that I knew that told me that, but the two people running that company were both women. And
oh yeah, that we came, do it to each other all the time.
Yeah. It's like, we can't even be advocates for each other. That's right. My biggest thing. It's like, we're supposed to be, you know, women lifting other women up and being supportive of each other. And we're our greatest enemies.
This is internalized misogyny. This is another thing I wrote about in the book. And honestly, like, some of the most difficult and uncomfortable work that I've ever had to do is how we treat other women. We have been conditioned to do that. It's not our fault. It truly is something that we've been conditioned to do. And this manifests as chronic dieting. It manifests as slut shaming. It manifests as being so competitive in the workplace where we undermine other women. I mean, I'm sure we've all been in that situation where somebody's gossiping about us and spreading rumors, or just being incredibly difficult to work with, you know, another woman. This happens in family structures, especially where women are being competitive to the proximity of whoever the patriarch is. This it happens so much. And the most difficult part is when you start to see yourself in it. You know, I have colleagues who, I haven't run Facebook ads in a long time, but I have plenty of colleagues who do. And the amount of hate comments that they get from other women is unreal. And, you know, and we keep saying that, like, well, why is there so much infighting? Like, why are women not lifting each other up? It's like, we've been taught to do this. We have been taught to do this. That's misogyny. And so many of us have it internalized, myself as well. I am not immune to this. So my point is that, you know, for anyone who's new to the term, I invite you to Google it, and it's going to be a humbling experience when you realize that you have been a victim to it as well. I think the point I really want to drive home is that it's not your fault. We have been more or less trained to be this way.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I don't like it.
I know.
I don't like the truth.
And it's like, you just have to, like, I think that you just need to, I don't know. Like, I do think it's an issue, and you are right. I run Facebook ads, and I'm blown away on a fairly regular basis at the comments that are made and the boldness. Would you say that to my face, really? And how people feel they can say things. And one night, I happened to be up. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not a super fast typer on my phone like some people are. I'm not as fast. And so she was asking a question, and I was responding, and then she said, "Figures no one would respond." Then she continued on, and then she made this crazy comment like, "Oh, this is just a bot. I knew it was a bot. You don't even care about your customers anyway." And so then I was like, "Actually, it isn't. I just happened to be jumping into bed and decided to look at my phone really quick before I turned it off, and thought I would go ahead and answer tonight so I don't forget about it in the morning. But this is a person. Oh, I'm so sorry. I just didn't really think you were a real person." So you can, yeah. Like, really? Like, I don't even know. I was just crack kind of like, was making me angry that I wasn't able to even type as fast as she was making these rude comments back to me. And then like, oh, now that you're a real person, then I guess I'll back off a little bit. Right. Or this is the person that actually ran the ad. It was the most interesting, like, conversation. And I said, I'm happy to take care of you or whatever your situation is. Like, gosh, that's what we're here to do. And then I think she was a little embarrassed, but it was like, why would you behave that way?
Like, well, good. Like, I hope she was embarrassed and a little bit ashamed even, because so then she could, or at least guilty, so she can change her behavior. And I wouldn't point that so much to internalized misogyny as just it is entitlement. I think that we are so entitled to people's time, especially on the internet, especially with the ability to DM people who have lives and sometimes lots of followers. And it blows me away. I don't know if it's because I'm a little bit older that I don't feel entitled to people's time, especially in private messages and emails. Like, I would never turn on one of those autoresponders that has to explain to people that they only check email twice a week. Like,
right.
You should only check email twice a week. Like, why are we in this place now where we expect people to check their email a dozen times a day and respond within an hour? Like, no, ma'am.
Gosh, Andrea, this has been great. I don't want to leave our conversation without talking about our signature question, and that is of the show, and that is, what does working from your happy place mean to you?
100% it means working from my values. And I look at those every few years because they might change. And right now they are courage, responsibility, and transparency. And as long as I am working from that place, no matter what, even if what I'm doing is incredibly uncomfortable and something that I don't really want to do, I know that I'm going to be okay. I know that things are going to work out and the universe is going to take care of me.
Wow, that is awesome. Well, this has been an absolutely delightful interview. Thank you so much for sharing your words of wisdom and having some frank conversations. I absolutely loved it. And it's been great. So thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me get up on my soapbox. And there's a ton of bonuses with this book. It's at andreaowen.com/noise if anybody wants to grab those.
Great. And where else can you repeat that again, just a little slower? And then also, where else can they follow you?
Yeah. So the website is andreaowen.com. It's Owen without an S. And the book and the bonuses, all the free stuff, is at andreaowen.com/noise. And then I like to hang out probably the most on Instagram, and I'm at Hey Andrea Owen over there.
All right, great. And we'll make sure to put some of that in our show notes as well. So once again, thanks, Andrea. And thanks to all of you for listening and taking the time today. We appreciate you so much. Make sure that you remember to subscribe or follow. That way you don't miss a single one of our awesome interviews. And share us with a friend. That's the greatest compliment that we can receive. So we'll see you next time on Work From Your Happy Place.
Thanks for joining us at Work From Your Happy Place. If you like what you hear, please share it with your friends and be sure to rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher. For a free gift on finding your own happy place, please visit workfromyourhappyplace.com and click on the free audio button. Thanks again for listening.